Monitor 67, your window on the weekend world with news, sports, comedy, and music. The most exciting sounds around. Coming up in this half hour, Monitor Music with Ed Ames, Bert Camford, and Patty Page, who, incidentally, will be on hand in person right here in Radio Central. I'm Brad Crandall. To kick off Monitor Music, here are the Trombones Unlimited with It's Not Unusual. Time to perform one of the more pleasant duties that fall to the lot of a broadcaster, that of introducing a charming young lady sitting right here in the Monitor studio with me right this minute. Now, some of her friends know her maybe as Clara Ann Fowler, and to others, she's Mrs. Charles O'Curran, but to you and me, she's Patty Page. Patty, welcome to Monitor.
Thank you, Brad. Nice to be here.
You just recently came back from a tour of the Far East, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes, just before Christmas. We were gone 6 weeks around the world, in fact.
Oh, my goodness. What sort of places did you visit, if you can ask?
Well, they were all service clubs and army camps. And I would say out of the 6 weeks, I only did about five shows for natives in about three different countries. Other than that, it was all for the boys.
Was this State Department, Defense Department?
No. It was a private booker. And I don't know what would have happened if we'd gone through the State Department or how many more places we could have played, except right in Vietnam proper.
You know, there was a time when if a booking agent came to you and said, honey, I can get you a week in Da Nang, you know, you'd have thought it was pretty bad, but now it makes a little sense.
Yes, now it does.
When you were in Bangkok, you met a king, according to one of the things I said.
The king.
Yeah. What is that name again?
I can't pronounce it myself.
I can't either. I'm trying to. I'm just... Bumibol Adres... Oh, forget it.
Charming heavens, man.
Yeah, thank heavens our relationship with Thailand doesn't depend on you or me. I hear he's a songwriter.
Yes, he is. He's written about 25 songs. And he started out by playing saxophone and clarinet, and most of them were written as instrumentals, and then he put the lyrics to them.
Yeah, I remember reading occasionally about him years ago, about sitting in with the odd jazz group or bringing them over to the palace and letting them work.
He loves music. He has his own orchestra that he conducts on a Friday night and has his own radio station.
The Royal Jazz Band.
Right.
That's got to be pretty well.
Before we might do a couple of his songs.
Are you thinking about it?
Yes, we brought them all back here, And so we're now going through them. I won't be recording till March. But we're going to go through all of them. And as I said before, there are a lot of them that are really for instrumentals.
Well, I was just wondering now, if he played the instrument you mentioned, clarinet and sax, but he learned the music that he grew up on, of course, is quarter tone, isn't it?
Well,
he didn't write anything for quarter tone, surely.
Is that what comes from Boston?
Or whatever.
That's where he spent most of his time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Before your Far East tour, you were in Europe for quite a while, again on a tour thing. How long? When was that?
Well, this was the same time.
The same basic tour.
We started in Germany,
mm-hmm.
and went from there to Bangkok, went around the world that way.
I see. Well, now, then you entertained troops primarily in just about every place where they were.
Yes, all over Germany and in France.
Uh-huh.
One of the last bases there, right across the border.
Yeah, you have to hurry.
Yes, they sure had cleaned it out, too.
You don't sing any long songs because they're going to be there.
We left pretty quick.
Uh-huh.
But it was interesting. It was all service clubs over there.
Did you, what about the comparison of the troops which you saw in various places? Did there seem to be any big difference between them?
No, I don't think so, because a lot of the boys that we met in Germany had been in Vietnam.
Mm.
And a lot of them were going. And even when we got to Okinawa or Manila, any of the other places...
Oh, yes, Okinawa. Pearl of the Pacific.
Oh,
yeah.
Is it ever. The island of dreams. We saw them there.
Uh-huh.
And...
You almost ran into old friends then.
Right. And when I went to Japan, I would see a lot of the boys that we had seen in Bangkok who were on R&R at that particular time. So they never really know where they're going.
For the benefit of anybody who doesn't know, R&R is rest and rehabilitation, at least... legally.
Right. And they do take advantage of it, and I'm glad.
Patty, what about the new stuff that's coming out, like the rock tunes and this over-solid beat, this 8-bar beat and all this stuff? Are you happy with any of this?
Well, I enjoy all kinds of music, Bran. There are some songs that are in the rock vein that I'm not too happy with because I don't understand some of them, what they're singing or saying or what message they're trying to give.
No, I think that's part of the club. If you can be understood, you're out. You know. It's
And yet folk singing is what I think everybody has done that, made up their own song, so everybody is more or less could be considered a folk singer or writer because it's just singing about what you're feeling now, but at least you are hearing what they're saying.
Yeah.
But with the rock things, some of them, I'm not saying all of them, because, as I say, I like them.
Well, I've, of course, you know, as a little girl from, Claremore, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
You came from right out of C&W and country blues and folk music country.
This is right.
The whole background of it.
And as they say down there, and especially in the South, there is a big difference in Western, country and Western, and hillbilly.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been able to find it.
Well, you have to like it first and go from there.
Yeah.
One quick question about your own future, Patty. Where are you headed now? In what direction?
Well, I'm headed south.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, Puerto Rico, and then back out to Los Angeles, which is our home.
Mm-hmm.
And my two babies will be joining me in Fort Lauderdale next Wednesday.
Well, you inaugurated the multiple recording thing with a record call with my eyes wide open.
Uh-huh.
And I still remember the label because it didn't say multiple recording or anything. It had... vocal by, and then four times repeated. Patty Page, Patty Page, Patty Page, and Patty
right.
Page. And, of course, now it's being done and has been done many times in 100 different ways. Anybody ever turn to you and say, how does it feel to be a pioneer?
No, they haven't.
Thank heaven. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure, Brad.
We've been talking with Patty Page, recording artist, star of stage and screen, mother of two, and very nice young lady. Now, let's listen to that very nice young lady singing her latest, This Is the Sunday.
This is the church we would have come to. This is the book I would have held in my hand. This is the Sunday we were to be with. And the bells are ringing, but for her. This is the altar where way we would have stood.
Where you're always sure of meeting interesting people.
Right here on the Monitor Beacon.
Here we go again with Monitor Music. Here's Ed Ames, formerly one of the Ames brothers. No, come to think of it, he still is one of the Ames brothers, obviously. Just doesn't have anything to do with the others anymore. No, I mean, I'm sorry I brought the whole thing up. Here's Ed Ames to sing My Cup Runneth Over.
Sometimes in the morning, when shadows are deep, I lie here beside you, just watching you sleep. And sometimes I whisper what I'm thinking of. My cup runneth over with love. I study the small things you do constantly. I memorize moments that I'm fondest of. My cup runneth over with
Monitor Sports Desk now, Mel Allen, with Today in Sports, plus a look at the week ahead. Mel?
Thank you very much, Brad. Hello there, everyone. Well, 37-year-old Tom Neaporty, who hails from Locust Valley, New York, won the 90-hole Bob Hope Desert Classic Golf Tournament by one stroke from Doug Sanders, and everyone immediately began to wonder when he finds time to practice. Neaporty, who rarely appears on the tournament circuit, has 7 children, is expecting number 8. The Victory, his first since 1960, was worth $17,600. He was already in with a 90-hole score of 349 on a 69-11 under par. Started the day 1 stroke behind Sanders, who then finished 1 ahead when he sank a 12-foot birdie putt on the final hole. But while Sanders was playing in the next threesome, today barely missed his birdie putt on 18 and then parted for 71. We'll have a wind-up report on the tournament in the next hour with Neporty and Bob Hope as guests. In auto racing, it was a Ferrari sweep of the first 3 places in the 24-hour Daytona Continental, the winning car driven by New Zealander Chris Amon and Italy's Lorenzo Bandini. Porsche took 4th and 5th. A privately owned Ford GT40 was 6th, and the only Ford Mark II prototype to finish was 7th. The winning car traveled 2,537 miles at a speed of just under 106 miles per hour. In pro basketball, 2 games played this afternoon. The Boston Celtics turned back the Cincinnati Royals 137 to 121, and the Detroit Pistons defeated the St. Louis Hawks 114 to 104. There was bad news for the Baltimore Bullets. They've lost their high scorer, Don Old, for the rest of the season because of knee trouble. In tennis, Chuck Passerell upset top-seeded Arthur Ashe 6-3, 8-6 to win the Fidelity Indoor Tournament in Richmond. The two then teamed to capture the doubles championship 6-1, 6-4. Well, a Russian newspaper is saying Joe Louis is saying something he's never said in the United States without ever saying where Louis said what he's supposed to have said if he really said it. Isn't that confusing, Brad? Well, not really once you hear the story. The Soviet paper Kosmomolkaya Pravda quotes Louis as saying that he could have beaten Cassius Clay in his prime, that Clay's too self-confident, is helpless near the ropes, has a bad defense. According to the Soviet paper, Louis went on to say that Clay is a capable boxer, but not the greatest. And Joe concluded by adding, "The tongue has no bones. The main rule of the ring is to shut your mouth and keep your eyes open." I guess such a story coming out of Moscow was enough to make even Clay see red. Looking ahead tomorrow, the World Bobsled Championships in France, and Cassius Clay defends his heavyweight title against Ernie Terrell in Houston. Tuesday, the $50,000 Professional Bowlers Association Kansas City opened the Sam Griffith Memorial Offshore Motorboat Race at Miami. Thursday, 2 golf tournaments, the Phoenix Open and the Maracaibo Open in Venezuela. Friday, the United States Track and Field Federation Indoor Meet in New York, the Will Rogers Indoor Track Meet in Fort Worth. Willie Mays formally presents Sandy Koufax with the Cy Young Pitching Award. Saturday, 2 more track meets, the Los Angeles Times and the Dallas Invitationals, the Steamboat Spring Ski Classic in Colorado, 2 horse races, the San Antonio Handicap at Santa Anita, the Bougainvillea Turf Handicap at Hialeah. That's what is and will be in sports, Brad. And friends, this is Mel Allen reminding you that for more features and news from the world of sports, stay tuned to Monitor.
Now here's Bert Kempfert playing a sprightly little novelty called Pussy Puddin'. No pussyfooting when I tell you you're listening to Monitor, your weekend companion for information and entertainment at home or in your car, wherever you are in the USA. In central Louisiana, we're heard on KSYL, Alexandria, Louisiana. Now, sound off time for all NBC members, then we'll be back.
Further coverage of the Bob Hope Desert Classic Golf Tournament tonight on the NBC Radio Network.
Hello, Brad Crandall here from Monitor 67, weekend radio with something for everyone. In just 2 minutes, a look at rising food prices, their causes, and possible cures. First, let's listen to that incurable romantic Frank Sinatra with some excellent advice for young men everywhere. Give her love.
Give her sunshine in your smile. Give her pleasure all the while. Turn her thoughts from clouds of gray. Give her strength to face each day. Give her laughter. Be her friend. Stay beside her till the end. But in giving all else above, don't forget to give her
love. The recent housewives' boycotts of food markets across the country attracted a lot of attention in the press and caused a great uproar among food retailers, distributors, and government officials. But did the boycotts accomplish what they set out to do? A man who may be able to answer that question is our guest today, Mr. Doyle Connor, Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Florida. Welcome to Monitor, Mr. Connor.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Mr. Connor, were the housewives' boycotts successful?
Well, there's no way for me to determine whether they were successful. No doubt they focused attention on the food industry, and I think this is good. And no doubt it caused a reevaluation of merchandising practices, and there could be nothing wrong with this. Probably the best way to look at the total picture as far as food is concerned is to compare food with other things, other necessities. We have watched housing increase, say, from the base period back in 47 to 49. The last 20 years, it's gone up about 39%. And transportation's gone up about 57%. Medical expenses have gone up about 78%. And wages have gone up 100% during this span of time.
Mm-hmm.
And food has gone up 25%. Now, during 1966, food took a little bobble as far as a sudden trend in a price trend is concerned. And I think this got everyone excited. But as you stand off and look at it, the American food industry has done a rather commendable job of getting a very fine product into the marketplace. And this has been the demand of the consumer to build in more convenience. And this has cost some money. So you have the normal increase in cost, and then you have the convenience in packaging, which has cost the consumer considerably more in the last 20 years.
Now, your home state of Florida is a major producer, of course, of citrus fruits and vegetables. Everybody knows that. What a lot of people don't realize is that it's also, what, the second highest beef producer in the country, isn't it?
Well, it's not the second highest, but it is among the major beef-producing states in the nation.
Yeah, more cowboys in Florida than there are in Texas, I think.
Well, we could get up a little argument with Texas, but nevertheless, we may have some of the facts on our side.
Now, how about the question of whether there's an abundance or shortage of these products? Does it have any bearing on how much they cost the housewife?
We have had the most ideal growing conditions in Florida headed into the 1967 marketing period, growing and harvesting period in the history of the state. We will have the largest citrus crop, 188 millions of boxes. This means there will be an adequate supply, and all Florida fruits and vegetables operate in the free market, under the free enterprise system of no strictly a supply and demand proposition. Mm-hmm. So this means that all of the major consuming areas of the United States serviced by the Florida agricultural industry, citrus will be in abundance. This will mean that the citrus prices will be as low as they have been in, say, the last 10 years. Vegetables, we have had no frost damage in the state of Florida. Sunshine has been abundant, so we will have optimum and have had optimum growing conditions. So vegetables will be plentiful in the market area.
If there's a soy spot salesman listening, he's weeping all over us.
So with an abundant supply, we can very well expect the things coming from Florida, which would be your winter fruits and vegetables, to help stabilize the food price.
Mm-hmm. Now, in reference to meat, you mentioned a moment ago convenience foods, packaging. There's also the matter of regulation and taste. For example, as I understand it, practically all of us now eat grain-fed beef, which means that they're not slaughtered and shipped directly to the local market. In other words, if I buy a steak in Miami, it may be a Florida steak, but it didn't come to me from someplace else in Florida.
It made a long trip.
It went way to Kansas City for grain feeding.
I'm in the cattle business, and I ship feeders from our ranch. They go to the Southwest oftentimes, and they're grazed another year. We sell young feeders. They're grazed another year, say, in the are close to a year in the Southwest. Then they go to the Corn Belt.
Up into Chicago? Yeah,
that's right. And then they're finished out in the Corn Belt. And then eventually that same steak may end up in my...
And then people wonder why
my table.
Yeah, because by now it's traveled more than most citizens of this country.
That's right.
Thank you very much, sir, for being with us on Monitor.
It's my pleasure.
We've been talking with Mr. Doyle Connor, Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Florida. The song, Hurry Sundown, the artist, Hugo Montenegro, on the Monitor Beacon. Monitor once again at 15 minutes before the hour. Let's listen to the voice of Edie Gourmet as she sort of tiptoes up to the microphone in her chinchilla sneakers to sing Softly as I Leave You.
Softly, I will. So I leave you softly.
Now, at the drama desk, here's Monitor's man on the aisle, Leonard Probst.
Author Norman Mailer's first play, The Deer Park, opened last week off-Broadway. It's overly long and it's cluttered. Mailer has written it as a movie scenario with 88 scenes, and it suffers from a sloppy dramatic structure. Also, it's 25 years late, but possibly one needs that much time to get the wicked old Hollywood of the 40s into focus on stage. Despite its problems, a botched play by Norman Mailer is much more exciting and funny than the work by playwrights who know the form but haven't got the content. The Deer Park is the most authentically evocative and one of the roughest pictures of that old Hollywood era to reach the stage. It captures the all-permeating sexuality, the phoniness, and the vulgarity. The story deals with a talented movie director floored by the McCarthyites. It shows him battling his way back to success, but finally taking the count from the phonies. There is a vicious Hollywood gossip columnist, her son brilliantly played by Rip Torn, who is pure evil, and the best creation of all, a Hollywood czar, magnificently done by Will Lee. He is both a monster and a comic figure, a movie mogul who uses God and sex as his twin oracles. Turning to what's coming up on Broadway, the next opening is Tuesday night, with two short plays by Peter Schaffer. The first is called White Lies, the other Black Comedy, which I saw this summer in London. The star of Black Comedy is a 23-year-old redhead named Lynn Redgrave. Last week, she shared the New York Film Critics Award for the Best Actress of the Year for her performance in Georgie Girl. As to Miss Redgrave's reaction to getting the award...
In a way, awards for acting are bad ideas, really, if one's critical about it, because they're making it a competitive thing, which acting can't be, because there is nothing to prove that anybody is best. It's just a matter of opinion. There's no test you can pass, like, a thing in bookkeeping or a secretarial course where you're best if you go at millions of words a second. Therefore, it puts it into a sort of competitive thing of who's best. I mean, I'm not best actress. It's a false thing to say best actress of the year, because, in fact, it's levelled out by the fact that myself and Liz Taylor are the only people who had major female parts this year in films. So there are only two films which dealt mainly with a woman, and those were our two films. So it's a little bit of a false thing. It's very nice, but I'm not fooled by it, and other people shouldn't be either, you know.
But you got it for your acting ability, at least as judged by the New York Film Critics. Speaking
yes.
about your acting ability, you're about to make your debut Tuesday night on Broadway in a comedy called Black Comedy.
Yes.
Black Comedy is a very tricky comedy. It's quite unusual. Can you tell us about it?
Well, at the beginning of the play, when the curtain goes up, the stage and the audience are a complete blackout. Nobody can see anything. But the voices that the audience hear on the stage talking, the way they talk makes it obvious that they can see. Although, in fact, the audience can't see them. They can't see each other in reality. But they are talking and moving as if they can see. They're saying, you do look nice tonight, all sorts of things like this. From the moment the lights on the stage come up, and naturally the audience can then see the characters can no longer see. And from then on, when the lights are completely up, the actors are moving about as if they can see nothing. They're bumping into things, they're missing people, they're talking in the wrong directions, everything. If a character on the stage lights a match, the stage lights dim very slightly. Instead of going up normally, if you were in darkness and you lit a match, you would then be able to see. So it just happens in reverse. Everything happens in reverse.
And theoretically, the reason why the lights are out is because the fuse is blown?
That's right. A mains fuse is blown, and which has affected the whole building and this particular apartment as well. And therefore, other characters from the apartment building or visitors who are expected arrive in complete darkness as far as they're concerned. They can't see, and all the hazards and complications that happen and mistaken identities and terrible, terrible upsets that go on are the main theme of the play.
You are now playing the previews. You haven't...
We're playing it. We started previewing last night. We were in Boston for 2 weeks before that.
Are preview audiences muddled? Do they know how to react?
There's a little confusion, usually at the beginning, in the darkness. One or two people maybe haven't read, heard, or don't cotton on.
Do they complain?
And so they get you hear a few voices saying, oh, God, something's gone wrong. Oh, no, the lights have gone. And a few people last night lit matches to huge hisses from the rest of the audience who understood what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to play on regardless. It is very putting off, but we're prepared for that.
Well, you're trying to keep this idea a bit of a secret until opening night.
Well, I think the more people who know they're meant to be in a blackout at the beginning, the better, because otherwise they behave very peculiar. A lady in Boston started crawling out up the aisle, apparently. She met the company manager's feet, who was he's standing at the back, and grabbed his feet. It was all in the blackout, and he said, "Madam, you can't leave now. We're not allowed to open the doors." And she said, "I'm frightened of the dark." Because, of course, if the doors are opened at the back, light comes in, and it really does spoil it.
Let's go to London a minute. Your name is Lynn Redgrave. You're redheaded. You're a large, beautiful woman.
And what do you mean, large?
Big.
Tall.
Tall.
Slender, do you mind?
All right.
Look,
23.
Large.
Large.
Big. Handsome, all that.
That's
big.
A bad word. All right.
Rotten.
The Redgrave family, there's so many parts to that family. Can you explain who they all are? And
I expect so. There are five bits of us. There's a father called Michael Redgrave.
Sir Michael.
Yes, if you like. My mother, who is an actress called Rachel Kempson. My elder sister, Vanessa, who is my sister, Vanessa.
Who was in the film Blow Up and...
Blow Up and Morgan.
And the prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and is now filming Camelot in Hollywood. And my brother, Corin Redgrave, who is in a play called Lady Windermere's Fan in London. This can be seen at the moment. Sounded like a big plug, but you might as well know him. Man for All Seasons, and also The Deadly Affair. And then there's myself. And you can see me in The Deadly Affair, if you like.
Do you keep a list of where each Redgrave is seeable? At the...
No, it's sort of nice for me, though, as I'm away from home, that I can go to a movie house and see any one of them. It's quite nice.
Lynn Redgrave, member of a family of actors who will make her Broadway debut Tuesday night. This is Leonard Probst, NBC News, New York, and that's it from Broadway.
Sir Michael Redgrave's little girl, Lynn, now a big movie star in her own right. And a word for everyone who's interested in money.
Money, money, money! What great values I have for you! I'm the RCA Victor Value Man. Right now, I'm at your RCA Victor dealers during RCA Victor Value Days. Values by the storeful on new 1967 RCA Victor color TVs, on new radios, tape recorders, and stereo. Look for me, the Value Man, at your RCA Victor dealers. I have values galore for you.
Now, a riddle. What two piano team is like a steam shovel and a searchlight? The answer, Derek and Ray. And that's the last time I'll ever buy a joke from the elevator boy. Anyhow, here are Derek and Ray with Delicado.
Thank you.
You're tuned to the swinging sound of Monitor 67. I'm Brad Crandall, reminding you that NBC News on the Hour is coming up, and then we'll be back.
Coverage of the Bob Hope Desert Classic Golf Tournament tonight on the NBC Radio Network.